Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. The federal pot of money that's supposed to keep local roads and bridges intact may soon be empty, but lawmakers on Capitol Hill are miles apart from each other. It remains unclear if they'll be able to bridge the Gulf. Matt Laszlo reports on how the Wyoming delegation is weighing in on the debate that's sucking the air out of Washington this summer.
While more fuel-efficient cars and trucks may be good for your wallet and the environment, they may not be so good for the roads you drive on. The Federal Highway Trust Fund relies on an 18-cent per gallon gas tax. If you drive diesel, the government hits you for 24 cents per gallon each time you fill up. Vehicles driving farther on less mean the current formula, which was developed in the 1990s, leaves the Highway Trust Fund facing insolvency. Wyoming Senior Senator Mike Enzi says transportation officials everywhere are bracing for when the money runs out.
I don't think there's any state in the nation that isn't going to be hurt by the end of all infrastructure construction, and that's supposed to happen sometime during August. So there will be a huge outcry from people across the country whose jobs are being affected by that. Infrastructure and being able to travel is a big part of the United States, but it's an even bigger part of Wyoming.
The pending crisis is sparking a debate in Washington over the future of U.S. transportation funding. Enzi says part of the problem is that the highway formula did not keep up with inflation.
We've had a lot of inflation since 1993, which was the last time that the gas tax was raised, and there are other kinds of energy that are used in automobiles now, and they're not being taxed for the highways that they're using. So something needs to be looked at.
Enzi, an accountant by trade, says there's been another problem of late, raiding the fund.
Over the last 4 years, we've decided that the highway fund would tap into everybody else and doing some really phenomenal bad bookkeeping things. We stole from the pension benefit trust fund, and we stole from the abandoned mine land trust fund for 10 years to build highways for 2 years.
While many Democrats say it makes sense to just raise the gas tax, Republicans are using the pending crisis to try to change the long-term use of the trust fund. Many don't like that about 15% of it goes to rail, while untold billions goes to environmental mitigation and highway beautification projects. Wyoming Congresswoman Cynthia Lummis says the highway fund should pay for highways.
Use the money that is raised for the highway trust fund to literally shore up the funding for the real roads and bridges that we need to get back in a state of repair.
House Republican leaders are scrambling to find a solution so they can avoid the blame if the fund goes broke. One proposal they offered is ending most Saturday postal service and putting the savings in the highway fund. The idea is seen as a temporary fix by lawmakers in both parties, applying future savings to today's trust fund shortfall. Lummis doesn't like the sound of that.
I'm not comfortable with a number of the proposals I've seen, including taking a provision that would bring about some savings due to 5-day delivery of mail as opposed to 6-day delivery of mail, and take savings from the U.S. Postal Service and then apply them to the Highway Trust Fund.
Lummis likes a bipartisan idea to give companies with holdings overseas a temporary tax holiday. The trillions of dollars held by companies overseas could come back to the U.S. at greatly reduced tax rates. That repatriated revenue could be used to replenish the fund, according to Lummis.
I think it's good public policy all the way around to repatriate those dollars and put them to work in the United States.
But reforming the tax code is a touchy political issue that could take years, and lawmakers just have weeks to find a solution. California Democratic Senator Barbara Boxer says if most Republicans are unwilling to raise the gas tax, they ought to just scrap it and make oil companies pay a fee.
I'd like to do away with the gas tax and replace it with a user fee at the refinery level. Then we would never have a gas tax. That's my favorite proposal.
Wyoming Senator John Barrasso says that could hurt the state's booming energy sector.
Gasoline prices are already high. The president's policies continue to drive them higher. And if the president is really concerned about our economy, you ought to be focused on developing American energy instead of just turning more and more to the Middle East.
This week, a House and a Senate committee separately passed bills to inject $11 billion into the fund to keep it going until May. It's paid for with customs fees and by allowing companies to defer their pension payments. There are still major differences that have to be worked out, but critics say Congress is doing what they've always done in the past. Congresswoman Cynthia Lummis says she fears lawmakers will again put off solving the problem as the deadline for the Highway Trust Fund quickly approaches.
That is our history, is to kick the can down the road, patch it, put a Band-Aid on it, use some baling wire, and limp along until after the election.
The Federal Department of Transportation is warning there are just weeks until it will have to start slowing the flow of checks to states. State transportation officials are hoping lawmakers can find a short-term solution so they don't have to stop construction, even if they say the nation desperately needs a long-term strategy. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
The problems for Wyoming highways don't stop there. It is not unusual for some employers in the state to have a hard time finding enough workers. That can be a headache for business owners, but lately it's the cause of some public safety concern as well. The Wyoming Highway Patrol is down almost 20% of its officers and is struggling to attract new ones. Wyoming Public Radio's Miles Bryant reports.
It's a clear morning at the Wyoming Law Enforcement Academy in Douglas, and cadets are in the parking lot doing drills. This one is a roadside stop gone wrong scenario. The officer-to-be has pulled over a car with Washington plates.
I see those drugs in your waistband, so can you put your hands right here?
What
on the,
drugs?
On the, right there. Just go ahead and put your hands
in Washington.
Can you step back over there for me?
They're just legal.
Step back there.
They're legal in Washington.
Not legal here.
Well, why not? That's not weed, man.
Suddenly, the female passenger pulls out a gun and aims it at the cadet, but he sees her and he's quicker to the draw. Thankfully, that was just a paintball gun. After a couple more weeks of training like this, these students will head out to law enforcement agencies all across the state. But of the 36 cadets here, only 4 will be joining the Wyoming Highway Patrol. While the patrol pays well in comparison to other Wyoming law enforcement agencies, it's a tough job. If you sign up, there's a good chance you'll be stationed far from home. Also, the minimum age for applying to the patrol is 23. That's compared to 21 or younger for other police jobs in Wyoming. And the application process is much longer than any other law enforcement job.
We're starting to feel some of that pain, obviously, because of the amount of shortage we have.
That's Highway Patrol Lieutenant Keith Gunther. Right now, the patrol is short 30 officers out of its usual capacity of 170. Gunther says it's the worst position his agency's been in for decades.
When we talk about troopers getting called out in the middle of the night to work crashes, those troopers that are currently working are having to do that more frequently, and they don't have those other personnel in their divisions to help even that load out.
Gunther says the problem is largely a cultural one. Kids just don't grow up wanting to be cops anymore.
When I grew up and others in the agency that have been around for 10-plus years, you know, when we were kids, that was quite an honor to go in law enforcement and become a police officer or a state trooper. And that's kind of went away a little bit in our society.
My grandfather was a highway patrolman for a while, and we just had a series of just a family thing almost to be in law enforcement or to be involved with the criminal justice system in general.
That's Cadet Remington Roberts. He's a classic recruit, a Wyoming native who grew up idolizing the badge. He even has a great cop name. But Roberts said he did consider a different career, following his friends into the oil fields.
They're making pretty good money, and it's always been a consideration to do that, but their shifts are just ridiculous. I don't think it's worth it.
But these days, that isn't a very popular position. Byron Odekoven, executive director for the Wyoming Association of Sheriffs and Chiefs of Police, says for most law enforcement agencies, even keeping officers is difficult.
Several agencies commented that they're having current officers leave current positions for additional pay and benefits.
And the applicants they do get, well, they aren't always cop material.
Of those who did apply, they may have recent drug usage, alcohol abuse issues. You know, they're just casting a net out for a job, and those kinds of people do not make good officers.
Back at the Law Enforcement Academy in Douglas, Lieutenant David Wagner is scrolling through the Highway Patrol's Facebook page.
Looks like we've had 91 shares, and we're up to about 825 likes, and looks like 47 comments at this point.
Wagner is the Highway Patrol's newly minted social media coordinator. He says he wants to use Facebook and Twitter to reach Wyoming kids before they take an energy job or are snagged by another law enforcement agency. But he says he'll need some training first.
I have never used Twitter in my life. I know our agency has a Twitter account. I have yet to go on there and utilize it yet. And hopefully with some training and experience, I can utilize that.
But the Highway Patrol is looking at financial solutions to its recruitment problem, too. This year, the officers got a raise. It was the first they've seen in 6 years. For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Miles Bryan.
When we come back, we'll have a story on how the federal government is following the state's lead in trying to save the sage grouse. And we'll have an interview with Clark Stith. He's a candidate for Secretary of State. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. The clock is ticking on whether to list the greater sage grouse as an endangered species. Such a listing could all but shut down mineral development in the bird's habitat. States already tackled sage grouse protections. Now it's the federal government's turn. It's been 30 years since the Land or Resource Management Plan was revised. While updating it, the Bureau of Land Management took the opportunity to review sage grouse protections. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports, there's lots of disagreement over the merits of its approach.
The Land or Resource Management Plan is hundreds of pages long and covers a lot of ground.
Wilderness, wild horses, wildlife, including sage grouse, lands and realty, recreation, cultural resources, minerals, all the things that BLM does across the landscape.
In other words, it's not exactly light reading. But in fact, buried in all those pages are some groundbreaking approaches to managing landscapes on the large scale. As Kristen Yanone, the lander planner for the BLM, says,
it's been called a plan of firsts. It's first in a lot of things.
For instance, it's the first of 15 plans scheduled to be released covering the 11 states located in sage-grouse country. Four of those plans are in Wyoming, home to one-third of the world's remaining sage-grouse population. Another first for the lander RMP is its adoption of the so-called Core Area Strategy. That's the state of Wyoming's all-purpose policy tool for designating important sage-grouse habitat. And the federal government's decision to use that strategy is what's causing the most disagreement about the RMP.
There is decades of research available on the grouse and its habitat.
That's Director Mark Salvo with Defenders of Wildlife.
We know a lot about this bird. The less disturbance that occurs in breeding, nesting, and brood-rearing habitat, the more sage grouse you're likely to have.
And Salvo doesn't think the core area strategy does enough to minimize the disturbance. He says it ignores the BLM's own science because it only protects the birds seasonally, not year-round. And it only gives sage grouse leks, the breeding sites where the males perform their famous dance, a buffer zone of 0.6 miles. He points out that a scientific review team for the federal government, the National Technical Team, recommended a 4-mile buffer.
The National Technical Team report was guidance to be used in land use planning, not a prescription of hard and fast rules that must be applied in every situation.
That's Lander Field Manager Rick Vandervoet. And the governor's natural resources policy advisor, Jeremiah Riemann, agrees. He says the buffer zone rule has to be flexible to manage the needs of multiple land users.
I think that the criticism is comparing apples to donuts here.
He says you can't compare the 4 miles recommended by science to the 0.6 mile. That's because the 4 miles is recommended for males and females during their breeding and nesting period. The core strategy actually gives them 5.3 miles during that time. Riemann says the 0.6 mile applies only for male birds. But again, the 5.3 mile protection is only enforced seasonally. And so the argument goes round and round. But whatever the details might be, there's the issue of whether the core area strategy will even work. Ed Arnett is the director of Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership, a sportsman's group. He says studies show the core area strategy won't increase the populations. It will only keep them from decreasing. He says the federal government needs to aim higher.
I think people tend to forget that the core strategy is not necessarily a panacea to save, you know, the sage grouse and develop long-term increases in populations. There's still projected losses even with the core strategy in place.
But Julia Stubel with Wyoming Outdoor Council says the job of the management plan isn't to focus exclusively on sage grouse. She says it does a good job of balancing protections for lots of wildlife species.
I mean, all of our big predators and our kind of neat species, lynx and possibly wolverines. And so that decision to keep those areas well protected from industrial development has amazing impacts for the other wildlife species beyond the sage grouse.
And she says there are protections beyond those for sage grouse that will also protect the bird.
The National Historic Trails Corridor is off limits to oil and gas surface use, but that crosses sage-grouse core area. So it's not done in the name of sage-grouse, but there are overlapping protections that strengthen the overall impact of the plan. And that's what the Oregon Door Council sees as being really strong about this plan, but also why it shouldn't be a template or a model used in other places.
Right now, that's the BLM's plan for the rest of the management plans being drafted. But Stubel says using Lander as a cookie cutter would be a mistake, since every landscape is unique. She says each one deserves its own tailored plan. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
Changing gears, we're going to go and talk to Republican candidate for Secretary of State Clark Stith. He's a business attorney in Rock Springs, where he's also been the chair of the Sweetwater County Republicans. He's one of four candidates running for the office. One of the things Stith would like to do is actually make some downsizing in the Secretary of State's office.
Sure. Here's the specific area inside the Secretary of State's office that I would like to streamline is in the business division, because right now you have about a third of the employees there are working in a mostly paper-based, white-collar assembly line type of work. It's a process that hasn't changed much in a couple of decades. Even the federal courts, by contrast, you can do online original filing. What I would like to do is to take that division and provide for online original corporate filings. That would provide both better customer service because legitimate companies could get formed same day, whereas now it takes at least 5 days processing time, and with the mail, often it's 10 days. So we'd have better customer service while making the process less labor intensive.
So you just wouldn't frankly need some of those people.
That's right, and these are all good people. They're mostly college-educated people in their 20s and 30s, and the idea is that you would set them free to go off and do other things. And this is a process that would be done in an orderly, deliberate fashion. This is not walk in and just point at people and say you're fired. That's not the point. What you do is you update it and bring it into the 21st century. I mean, after all, what's the alternative to keep a paper-based process forever? I don't think that quite makes sense. It fits into a larger notion that our government sector is just a bit larger than it needs to be.
One of the things that a lot of the candidates have talked about is beefing up the technology and modernizing the office a little bit. I wonder if you would ever consider shifting some of the positions from that particular division and putting it into things that would look into fraud, shell companies, that sort of thing.
Sure. Well, that is in my small government toolkit. The first tool is to create this express lane for legitimate companies to do same-day online filing. But the second tool in this small government toolkit is to create a dead end for phony companies. Quite amazingly, it's estimated by the Secretary of State's office that 3/4 of the companies that call Wyoming home have no genuine business tie to Wyoming. I don't think that's necessarily healthy. I don't think Wyoming should sell its good name for a $100 filing fee.
Clark Stith visiting with us. He's a Republican candidate for Secretary of State. One of the banes of my existence, Clark, is when I cover elections and we see, there's a bottleneck somewhere in a particular county, or maybe we don't get results back as quickly as possible. Selfishly thinking as perhaps a broadcaster here working on election night, but I'm curious about that. Do you think there's ways to maybe get that information done out quicker and maybe get the votes counted a little bit better than we're doing that now, not only from a statewide standpoint, but even maybe providing some leadership to some of the counties?
As you know, Bob, the Secretary of State is the chief elections officer of the state of Wyoming. Each of the county clerks in the 23 counties are the chief elections officer for their respective counties. So it is a matter of coordinating with all 23 counties. I believe the county clerks do a good job. They work very hard on election day to make sure they get the results right. I think preserving the integrity of the process is extremely important. The elections division runs pretty smoothly, runs pretty well. A lot of resources are put into that. Certainly, one of my goals would be to coordinate with the county clerks to make sure that we can get all of the precincts reporting and get the results as quickly as possible. To the extent that we can add technology for that so that you have real-time reporting, that would be an upgrade that would make sense to me.
What are there other changes or other things you'd like to bring to the Secretary of State's office?
Sure. To weed out the phony companies, I think it might be easier than first appears. My proposal would not require any new government employees, would not require any new money, really. You would just add two lines to the corporate form. First line would ask whether this company has genuine business ties to Wyoming, and if it does, then Wyoming is business friendly, and so I would not want to harass or hassle people who are legitimately doing business here where they own land here. Whereas if someone is in Argentina or Eastern Europe and they want to form a limited liability company, I believe it's fair to ask them to disclose who their beneficial owners are. By asking that, the good actors, people who are doing legitimate business in foreign countries or out of state, they should not mind identifying who the true beneficial owners are, whereas the bad actors should self-select out. So it's a way to weed out the hundreds, if not thousands, of companies that may be trading on Wyoming's good name. The third, the other piece in this toolkit is to deals with securities regulation. It's a little known aspect of the Secretary of State's office that the Secretary of State is the regulator for the state version of the securities laws. And the federal government has just changed securities laws to make crowdfunding legal. And that could be used in connection with properly balanced public-private partnerships to revitalize downtown areas by providing private capital for revitalization of downtown areas. It gets a bit complicated, but that would be a way to a tool that Secretary of State could provide to local communities.
Mm-hmm. Maybe one last thing before we let you go. State lands, certainly a big thing that all the top five elected officials have to deal with. What's your position on the sale of state lands and maybe the disposition of them? Would you favor selling them?
Our current system of multiple use works. I don't believe it would be fair, for example, to a rancher with an agricultural lease to suddenly demand that the rancher pony up cash to pay for it. So our current system of multiple use works. I do not want any net increase in state lands, but our current system of allowing multiple use, I believe, works. So I think that if we engaged on an aggressive program of just selling state lands, that would could rip the rug out from underneath the investment-backed expectations of people who, say, for example, have bought a ranch with a state grazing lease, for example, being a significant portion of the value.
Clark Stith is Republican candidate for Secretary of State. Pleasure chatting with you, and good luck in the rest of the campaign, and thank you for joining us.
Bob, thank you very much.
Coming up after a break, we'll hear about a massive expansion of the country's pipeline network and a new distillery in Mills. We'll also hear about the wait for a new high school in Rawlins. That's just ahead. You're listening to Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. In the first quarter of 2014, the United States surpassed both Russia and Saudi Arabia as the world's largest oil producer. It already hit that mark for natural gas late last year. All oil and gas has to be transported from the fields where it's drilled to refineries and processing plants, and most of that is done by pipeline. But as Wyoming Public Radio Stephanie Joyce reports, the nation's pipeline infrastructure is not currently up to the task.
Driving along Wyoming Highway 91, just west of Douglas, rancher Bob Kaiser points out the window of his white pickup truck.
See these pipeline markers? There's three pipeline markers that go right across me here. And the fourth pipeline is on the other side of the house where we are.
A short ways up the road, Kaiser points out another landmark.
See, this is the Oregon Trail across here, and that's why the pipelines and the power lines follow this, because this was the easiest way for the settlers to come across, and it's also the easiest way for the power lines and pipelines.
Because of that, there's a huge pipeline corridor. While Kaiser has four on his property, some nearby landowners have as many as 10. Kaiser says it's both a positive and a negative. The positive, the pipelines carry natural gas away from oil wells, which reduces gas flaring, a source of harmful air emissions. And the pipelines get truck traffic off the roads. But the negative, in Kaiser's opinion, is that pipeline companies have an unfair advantage over landowners. That's because of eminent domain, which allows them to essentially put the pipeline anywhere they want.
When they put that pipeline in, you're then prohibited from using the surface for anything but agricultural operations. If I want to put up a machine shed, I have to maintain a distance from the pipeline. So I lose the right to use my surface, and I get a small one-time payment.
And the pipelines that currently run across Kaiser's property aren't likely to be the last. To deal with a glut of natural gas coming out of nearby oil wells, a processing facility is being built across the street. That means more pipelines, and at least one of those could cross his property. And that's just the beginning. More than 500,000 miles of new pipeline will be built in the United States by 2035, according to a new study by the Interstate Natural Gas Association of America. That's 22 trips around the Earth, and then some. A sizable chunk will be built across the Rocky Mountain West.
North Dakota in 2012.
That's Justin Kringstad with the North Dakota Pipeline Authority.
Put over 2,400 miles of new pipe into service. And when you think about, that's the distance from Los Angeles to New York City in 1 year's time frame, all taking place within the state of North Dakota.
This year, three major crude oil pipeline projects will start moving oil out of the Bakken, the major shale play in North Dakota and eastern Montana. Two of them will run through Wyoming. Kringstad says companies are building as fast as they can.
That pace of 2,400 miles per year, it's definitely not slowing down.
It's a similar story across the country. On a recent trip to Pennsylvania, I toured part of Washington County, where a lot of new gas development is happening in the Marcellus Shale. Everywhere, there were big tracts of newly deforested land where pipelines had been laid. And that estimate of 500,000 miles might be low. Kringstad says his first attempt to predict Bakken oil production back in 2008 was so wrong.
It's almost laughable that we had such low expectations.
The uncertainty is common across most shale plays, from the Bakken to the Marcellus to the Niobrara in Wyoming and Colorado. And that complicates the task of estimating how much pipeline will need to be built. Wyoming Pipeline Authority Director Brian Jeffries says he has a pretty good handle on how much new pipeline will be needed for natural gas and natural gas liquids in the next decade. But
crude oil, man, I couldn't call that one for you.
But Jeffries says for the most part, the new pipelines will go unnoticed by the general public. For example, in a single half mile of I-25 between Cheyenne and the Colorado state line,
there's roughly 3.5 billion cubic feet a day of gas going through there, which is about 1/20 of the U.S. daily average consumption. And they go up and over the bluff where that buffalo silhouette sits up on the bluff and head off. And nobody notices them.
That is, until something goes wrong, which is entirely possible. Right now, each federal inspector is responsible for almost enough pipeline to circle the earth. With the addition of hundreds of thousands of extra miles, it's not clear how they'll be able to keep up. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
We'll have more on pipeline inspections and safety in upcoming shows. Talking about education now, for the past decade or so, Wyoming has been on a school-building binge, pumping hundreds of millions of dollars into new education facilities each year. Schools in or nearing the building process right now face challenges, as a busy construction season statewide is driving up costs. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Aaron Schrank reports, larger problems lie ahead.
It's a tense public meeting in Rawlins. School district officials here recently learned that the latest contractor bid to build a new Rawlins High School is $7 million over budget. Carbon County School District 1 Superintendent Fletcher Tricato says Rawlins isn't interested in making cuts.
4 months ago, we were within budget, and because of a bidding climate, now they want us to continue to take money out of this project. That's not going to happen. The board has said it's not going to happen. We're not going to do that to the people of Rawlins.
There's one representative here from the School Facilities Department, the state agency that oversees design and construction. His name's Dave Burnett, and the crowd here is pummeling him with questions. Chief among them, how do you expect us to cut $7 million from our school? His response?
We're looking to the design team to offer recommendations to get there.
Don't you have some general idea of where $7 out of $28 million would come?
Rawlins High School language arts teacher Mitch Alderman, like most here, isn't satisfied.
I mean, this is what you do for a living. Don't you have any general idea where 25% of it's going to change?
You know, one scenario.
The current Rawlins High School was built in the 50s with capacity for more than 1,000 students. With about 450 there today, the state closed off one wing of the school to save money on utilities and maintenance. People like Rawlins City Attorney Amy Bach are anxious to break ground on a new school.
I'm tired of our community getting the brunt end of the stick. We have two schools that have been in shambles and demolition, waiting for Cheyenne to get off their butt.
Many here blame the state for construction delays and inflated bids. Superintendent Turcato says the state wants to do more value engineering, or VE, basically looking to save money on design. He's not having it.
We're done arguing over the VE process, over taking this much money, taking flooring out, and making our new high school look like a prison. I've said it to the commission before, I'll say it again. We already have one prison in Rawlins. We don't want another one. We don't want our high school to look like it.
We have not asked the school district to cut $7 million. We have not asked anybody to do anything yet except give us a little bit more information about why it's over.
Bill Panos is director of Wyoming's School Facilities Department. He says the situation in Rawlins isn't unique. Construction demand in the state is high, it's late in the season, and that's driving up prices on many projects.
With the current bidding environment that we have in the state, we are getting about 50% of our bids are coming at the estimate or under the estimate.
And so those 50% that are over?
They're over by anything from 20 to 30%. There's none in the middle.
Panos says they'll find a solution for Rawlins and the rest of the overbid projects. The real problem facing his department is not whether it can keep large projects like Rawlins under budget. It's whether there's even going to be enough money in a few years to do projects like this. Senator Bill Landon is chair of the Select Committee on School Facilities. He says they've spent upwards of $200 million a year on school construction in the past decade.
So, you know, that's a pretty rapid pace of building.
That pace, Landon says, is soon to slow. That's because proposed federal regulations and a natural gas boom threaten the revenue source fueling this school building surge, coal. Wyoming currently uses coal leases to pay for schools, and that's going away.
The loss of coal lease bonus funding, which accounts for basically 90% of the funding for new school buildings. And so on the revenue side, that's going to take a major hit.
That hit is coming in the next few years, says Rob Godby, director of the Center for Energy Economics and Public Policy at UW. He's been commissioned to produce a report to determine how big it will be. It'll be ready this fall.
Yeah, our minds are wide open. We're collecting data. And it'll be a pretty busy next 3 months.
He says costs are expected to drop as Wyoming shifts focus from building new schools to maintaining existing ones.
And then the question becomes, what are the opportunity costs of maintaining a certain level? Do we want to improve them even more? Do we want to maybe allow them to depreciate a little and move towards the average across the country?
Godby and Landon both agree school construction will need to scale back in the future. As for the Rawlins problem, 1 week after their first meeting, Carbon County School District met with school facilities again, and the tone seems to have improved. Superintendent Turcato says there now appear to be several potential solutions. For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Aaron Trank.
These reports are part of the American Graduate Let's Make It Happen, a public media initiative to address the dropout crisis, supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Many people have ideas for small businesses, but not many of them quit their day jobs to try something unique, especially when it's something they know little about. But that's exactly what the Pollock family of Casper did in starting Backwards Distilling Company.
My son's an absinthe drinker, and absinthe is hard to come by, and he and she were talking and said,
why don't we just make some? And then we looked at each
other.
Yeah, we all did. We stopped and went,
That family conversation, as described by Bill, Kathy, and Amber Pollock, led to the three of them and son Chad to build and start the Backwards Distilling Company, where they plan on developing their own brand of vodka, rum, moonshine, and more. Chad Pollock is the chief mixer and is in charge of making the spirits.
This is a vodka that we're working on, so it's 100% wheat. We're using a red wheat in our vodka.
And Chad is standing near a massive copper and steel distillery in a structure that the family built in Mills. The family has invested its own money into the operation, and the four of them are the only employees. Amber and Kathy were teachers. Bill was a part owner of another business, and Chad was in school. Mother Kathy says dropping everything to do this together might sound crazy, but there was some thinking behind it. Part of it was to help her two children.
We were kind of looking for something that we could do as a family business. I started thinking that maybe, you know, the future's a little shaky, and so we wanted to do something that maybe they would have more control of their future. So we were kind of looking and trying to come up with an idea that we thought we'd all be happy with.
After the earlier conversation between Kathy and Chad and the knowledge of the success others had with craft beer, they decided to make their own alcohol.
Now, whether it's a good idea, I don't know, but so far it's been fun.
Bring it up.
As the chief distiller, Chad Pollock has traveled the country to get a feel for the business and to learn the trade. And he thinks the family is on the cusp of something great.
When we started this, there was only about 200 distilleries in the United States, and that was up by like double from the year before. And now there's almost 400 within just a little bit of time. So it's exploding.
He believes it'll be like the craft beer industry, although he anticipates it'll be challenging getting Wyoming people as excited about spirits as they are beer. That's where Sister Amber comes in. She has plans for an extensive marketing campaign, which includes opening up their distillery to the public.
Tastings, we'll have tours, we'll have an area downstairs where people can come and order drinks, try our stuff out.
The family has been at this for almost 2 years. Father Bill says they are anxious to finally hit on the right recipe and finally make some money. But they're being deliberate. They all know that other non-beer ventures in the state have been met with mixed reviews. He doesn't want that happening to them. That's why they will use independent testers and other distillers to check their quality.
We have done some testing, and we have unfortunately dumped some things down the drain that could have been dollar bills, but I think it's probably the smartest thing that we will have done, because when we get that product out, it's going to be worth having out there.
Chief Distiller Chad knows the rest of the family is counting on him to deliver.
You know, there is a lot of pressure. I feel pretty confident. I've learned a lot, and what I've made so far I think is promising. I've got some work to still do, but a lot of it's just growing pains into this new equipment.
The entire family says this will be a success if they can at least provide an excellent product to Casper and be able to give back to the community. But Amber also says it will be a success if they are not all broke and her parents are not living with her in a basement. The family wants to get their first batch to liquor stores this fall. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck. When we come back, America's original horse and the Wyoming family who saved the breed. That's all coming up on Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. This was almost the year of the thoroughbred horse with California Chrome's run for the elusive Triple Crown. But here's the story of a smaller, scrappier horse that overcame long odds with the help of a Wyoming family. Wyoming Public Radio's Micah Schweitzer has this postcard from a visit with the Spanish Mustang.
Living history comes thundering over the ridge. This is America's original horse. It's called the Spanish Mustang because it traces directly back to the horses first brought to the Western Hemisphere from Spain by Columbus in 1492. But let's jump ahead to just 100 years ago. Bob Brislon was a homesteader north of Moorcroft. He discovered the Indian, or cow pony, as it would have been called, while working with the U.S. Geological Survey. So Brislon set out to find more of the vanishing breed in remote, isolated canyons and on Indian reservations, where the bloodlines had remained pure over the centuries. From these mares and stallions came the Spanish Mustang Registry, established in 1957. And that lineage lives on at the Brislon family's Cayuse and Starflower ranches, rolling grassy hills in the shadow of Devil's Tower, the site of the original homestead. A call from breeder Kitty Bracelin and the promise of alfalfa cubes lures in the free-roaming bands of horses, each consisting of a stallion and a harem of mares, some with foals.
You can pet him if he a little bit, if he'll let you. He's gentle enough. He just doesn't want to be bothered.
That's Kitty's husband, Bob Brislon's son, Neil E. Bracelin. He uses the family name's old Irish pronunciation.
I always say I just keep them around for laughs because they're always up to something. I don't have any. I left it all in the car. I'll have to go get some more. Out on the deserts and places, there's nothing to eat. They have to eat just the weeds and junk that you can find. And these horses can live on brush and never see grass and do fine. You're just funny.
That hardiness let the horse flourish in the West after being introduced by the conquistadors. Spanish Mustangs are tough, small horses, measuring about 14 hands. Neil says they're a smooth ride because their back is short and their legs are springy. They're agile, able to make tight turns and stop on a dime, which can send the inexperienced rider tumbling. And they're smart, which E. Bracelin says can get them into trouble.
They think they know more about whatever you're doing than you do.
Years ago, Neil and Kitty had a neighbor who rode a Spanish Mustang mare for about 2 decades, but rider and horse never got along.
So one day, he decided, okay, I'm going to ride you to death. So he took off and he rode her in a big circle 120 miles. And he got back home and she threw him off in the pig pen. So he pulled out his six-shooter and killed her.
In the late 19th century, the federal government slaughtered thousands of Spanish Mustangs with machine guns in the effort to bring Native American tribes under subjugation, even putting a bounty on the horses. And in the 1920s and 30s, the government diluted the bloodline by crossbreeding with bigger Eastern horses. So when Bob Brislon set out to save the breed, the horses were scarce. There was also a lot of prejudice against them. Neil and Kitty remember people calling the horses dirty little ponies.
You can't fight them. You can't be mean to them. You got to be nice to them.
And everybody thinks you got to have a big horse to have a good horse. The only good horse is a thoroughbred, so to have a good horse, it has to have thoroughbred in it. Well, big is not better.
A plucky Spanish Mustang is the hero of the 2004 movie Hidalgo, for which the Bracelins were consulted. Viggo Mortensen plays a long-distance rider who wins a race on his Mustang against a pedigreed East Coast horse and rider.
Mustangs don't belong in races with thoroughbreds. If you ask me, they belong in fertilizer.
Mister, you can say anything you want about me. I'm going to have to ask you not to talk about my horse that way.
Thanks to the Brislon family standing up for the horse over the last century, things are different now. There are now a couple of dozen Spanish Mustang breeders around the U.S. There are also breeders abroad from Germany to Australia. And even Spain is showing renewed interest, bringing the indigenous Iberian horse full circle. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Micah Schweitzer.
Laramie photographer Dan Hayward has been taking pictures of these remarkable animals on the Cayuse and Starflower ranches. You can also see some of his photos on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. Dan is also organizing a photo safari to the ranches on July 31st to August 3rd. Registration information is at haywardphoto.com. It's now time for Wyoming Stories. Women in the United States have been fighting for equal wage rights since the early 1900s. In 1963, the government passed the Equal Pay Act, which aimed to abolish wage disparity based on sex. But the act excluded professional careers. Marilyn Dees juggled work as the first female executive director of the Wyoming Board of Pharmacy and as a single mother. She tells her daughter, Deborah Swedberg, how gender discrimination affected her life.
We were working 12, 13-hour days with no breaks. And so when I was home, we had to depend a lot on the babysitter being there from early morning until it was your bedtime. And on holidays, we're in a special problem. Why don't you tell about inspections?
Oh, my goodness. For three summers, what I remember is being the summer before my fourth grade, fifth grade, and sixth grade years, you would take and divide the state up into fourths, and we would run out inspection times. And you were very thoughtful. I remember staying at a hotel that had a swimming pool, if that was possible, and organizing your trip so that we would have inspections up until about 5 o'clock, and then you were on mom time, and so we would do dinner and pool, and then you would set us up for the morning while you would do your few inspections, come back and check us out, and if we were going to move to another town, then we would. Sometimes we'd have to spend the afternoon at the local park.
Sometimes you'd have to sit in the car and wait.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, I wanted to insert that because that was hard for you. And as you and Alan got older, it was harder and harder. I worked alone for about 5 years. And with the increase in drug use and the problems and the amount of inspections, we started interviewing and actually hired an inspector. And personnel, with all of his responsibilities, came back and said we should offer him a salary approximately $10,000 more than I was currently making, and I was responsible for him, and he would not have the obligations and the duties and the responsibilities I would. And I saw the salary. I was a little upset. And so ask, why should he be earning $10,000 approximately more a year than I am? I'm his supervisor. I'm responsible for everything he does. And the assistant attorney general said, well, because he's a man and he has to support family. I'm thinking, I've been supporting a family since 1963. And I don't understand why this should be happening. When I retired 15 years ago, the man who was hired as my replacement was paid approximately $20,000 more per annum than I was currently being paid after 31 and a half years.
That's Marilyn Dees from Casper talking with her daughter, Deborah Swedberg. Today, women in the U.S. earn about 80% of what men earn. You can hear more Wyoming Stories on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. If you'd like to hear it again, you can visit our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. There you can sign up for our podcast and listen to individual segments and comment on them. Our web editor is Anna Rader. You can also pitch us ideas for future shows on that same website. And don't forget, you can also become a fan of our Wyoming Public Radio News Facebook page. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.